Army before retiring last year. I'll be speaking at Maplewood High School tomorrow night, Thursday night at 7:30. Check our website. And on Saturday, I'll be in Berlin, Germany at Compaq's 10th anniversary. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkman, Nate Felsar, Martin and Shake, Steve Martinez, and Alpha Pani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan. Performance on Sunday, November 16th at 6 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan aims to promote, preserve, and share their culture. Their performance will include colorful costumes and elements of the Rajasthani arts of the spinning dance of the snake charmer, devotional singing, unusual instruments, storytelling, and ancient love songs. The caravan will also be joined by local performers Sedona Soulfire and Paul Evans. Again, that's Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan, Sunday, November 16th at 6 p.m., Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council faces heat over their choice to oversee police reforms.
The U.S. and China agree to a joint pact on climate change.
The weather forecast just got worse. We'll have details.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 12th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. At today's City Council meeting in Portland, the City Council went ahead with contracting an Illinois-based company to act as the community liaison with the Portland Police. The community liaison is a position created as part of the settlement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Justice Department. That settlement found that the Portland Police Department engages in excessive force when dealing with people suffering from mental health crises. The city decided to hire Dr. Dennis Rosenbaum, based in Illinois, to lead a team that includes retired Oregon Supreme Court Justice Paul J. DeMunez, who spoke at today's meeting.
In my own private life, I am a community voice and an advocate for reform of the child welfare policies in this state. I'm an advocate for justice reinvestment and the use of programs with regard to reentering prisoners. I have been involved in doing those things in our community, so I believe in the voice of the community. And so I'm going to dedicate myself in this process to making sure that the community voices are heard, that they're understood, and that they are an integral part of the implementation of this agreement. I think there needs to be a physical presence here for the liaison officer, and I'm encouraging them that I want to have access to office space here. I want to start right away, as soon as the negotiations or whenever I can, to start reaching out to the communities that are affected by this group and starting that dialogue. All of us are products of our background. Many of you know I was raised poor in Northeast Portland. I saw the justice system as a young person in a certain way, and so that's affected me, obviously, my whole life. As a young lawyer, I was very much involved in work involving making sure that the system operated fairly, and in particular, one case affected me greatly, and that happened to be someone who did not speak English in a murder trial, and I was eventually able to get that person exonerated, and the work that we did in that case actually transformed the system around the country for providing interpreter services in all different levels of things. My goal has been to make sure that the system operates fairly and can be accessed by all citizens. And if I take that back to what we're doing here, I think the most crucial thing here is that there is a voice for the community here. That is there's probably very few people that know this agreement better than I did. I read it hundreds of times during the mediation process, and I came to the conclusion that this is one of the most crucial pieces in providing the community voice.
The decision to pair up a retired Oregon Supreme Court justice with an out-of-state team to act as a community liaison drew criticism from community advocates in Portland. Becky Child, the only representative on the hiring team who objected to all of the candidates, said that none of the candidates were qualified because they lacked personal experience dealing with mental illness or mental health crises. She said there are substantial problems with both the process and the people involved. Child also criticized the decision by the city to appeal the judge's order requiring that city officials report their progress to the court each year. Other community members also testified at today's city council meeting against the choice of an out-of-state company to act as the community liaison.
It's very nice that Chief Demunis was here today and was able to say these things, but we didn't hear those things until after the public comment process was over. These were things that happened behind closed doors, and this is the problem we're trying to overcome, the decision-making behind closed doors. The reason we had a public process for the COCL was so that we would not have the city council making decisions on information the community didn't have. And instead, we find out that he's committing to 3 days a week. Portland police use force that generates a complaint one time every 9 days. They use force once a day on average. And we need somebody who's going to be here every day. And then if Justice Demunis isn't available, I haven't heard any talk of other staff being hired by the Chicago team to take his place if he's not available. And I, again, go back to the public process and the committee that was handpicked to make sure that there was voices of the mental health community helping decide who's going to be the COCL. And they all said, please don't pick the people from Chicago. And then you said, we're going to pick the people from Chicago. Commissioner Fritz said previously the community should have the final voice, but apparently the committee that said not to pick the team from Chicago is not part of that community voice. I also would like to point out that the other two candidates attended local meetings of the Community Police Relations Committee and the Citizen Review Committee in the lead up to the process, the final process here, whereas I didn't see anybody from the Chicago team trying to go out in the community here and meet people and see what was going on at these other meetings. And I also know that Albany Ministerial Alliance Coalition sent a letter to you, and the Human Rights Commission sent a letter to you. And last on a Monday evening, I heard some people from the Multnomah Youth Commission expressing their concerns about the decision being made. So we're not saying this by ourselves. We're hearing this from other people in the community.
I don't know where the community is going to break through to you about the public perception process. We know that one of the members of the Human Rights Commission resigned completely because you chose to go with the advice of the city attorney on a limited technical appeal. The city attorney seems to be becoming just a scapegoat for unpopular decisions. We have a communication process with the city attorney blamed for giving $5,000 to a cop who's now rehabilitated from his Nazi fetishism. And these are issues that are still burning in the community's mind, but they seem to not be on your mind anymore, not to mention the deaths since James Chassie. I hope that something will happen through former Chief Justice Demunis or this doctorate person from Chicago who will, in addition to doing oversight of these complicated technical legal documents help you realize that many people in the community don't really have faith in this process. I just really want to encourage you to have your ears open to every suggestion and inferred suggestion, especially that might come from the work of the Honorable former Chief Judge DeMuniz. We don't really have anything to go by on this Chicago team. Other groups, more local groups, showed the kind of community connection that we hope the Chicago team will also now implement now that they seem to be in the bag. But this repeated process of the city council or the mayor's office saying, well, it has to do with the city's attorney's office, and then people getting unpopular political decisions of this limited technical appeal and $5,000 and a complete whitewashing of his disciplinary record for now Captain Kruger, I hope that the 2015 will bring us a better level of trust and engagement between the citizens and the people on this council. Thank you.
That was testimony from today's city council meeting in Portland on the decision to hire an out-of-state company to serve as the community liaison to oversee the settlement between the Department of Justice and the City of Portland.
As cold weather creeps into Portland, the Red Cross has reopened their emergency winter shelter. Located at the Imago Dei Church on Southeast 13th and Ankeny, they're one of very few shelters that allow overnight stays with pets. Last year, the Red Cross was able to shelter over 2,600 individuals and 130 pets. The shelter opens every night that an emergency weather warning is issued. Another emergency winter shelter will open in the transitional housing area located at 665 Northwest Hoyt Street. The organization has encouraged the public to donate socks, gloves, and scarves to transitional housing. The cold snap that recently struck Portland has people reeling in its wake. Power to over 15,000 PGE customers was lost last night as wind speeds hit 66 miles an hour. And tomorrow's forecast is calling for up to a half a foot of snow.
A fire ignited Tuesday afternoon on the coast between Cannon Beach and Arch Cape. The fire started on land owned by Stimson Lumber Company and was swept along the coast by the heavy winds overnight. Firefighters are focused mainly on keeping the blaze contained until heavy winds die down. Currently, it is burning in slash piles in four harvested areas. No one faces evacuation.
The Oregon Department of Transportation released two reports Wednesday calling for over $5 billion to repair highways and bridges in Oregon. A major driving factor for the report is the future of Oregon's economy. According to one of ODOT's reports, if bridges and roads are not repaired, transportation costs will increase for businesses. Ultimately, this could cost the state over 100,000 jobs by 2035. The report also recommended major bridges around Oregon should be retrofitted to endure a large earthquake. These bridges include the Ross Island Bridge, the Astoria-Megler Bridge, and the Interstate 5 Bridge. The report claims strengthening these bridges could reduce economic loss to the state by $84 million in the event of a major earthquake. The ODOT reports did not suggest what the best approach to raising these funds would be. Some ideas include highway tolls, mandatory road use fees, increases in the gas tax, and an infusion of lottery revenue. The cost of keeping highways maintained to a two-car family would equate to about 0.75 cents per mile traveled, or about $15 per month.
The Derigold Company is coming under criticism for working conditions at its dairies. Workers at the company's dairies in Washington and Oregon say that they're working in unsafe conditions and that the company cows are mistreated. In response, United Farm Workers have taken on Derigold and are reaching out to retailers that carry Derigold products. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with Indira Trejo, Global Impact Coordinator for United Farm Workers.
Can you talk about why you're in town?
Yes, definitely. I'm in town because I was actually invited by the Pacific Northwest Farm Worker Ministry and the Populist Dialogue to do an interview about our campaign with the dairy farm workers from Derigold. They are from Pasco, from Jerome, from here in Woodland, Oregon. They're from the different dairies owned by Derigold Farms.
Can you talk about working conditions at those dairies?
It's the workers, they work from 8 to 12-hour shifts without any lunch or breaks. They don't have access to clean drinking water. A lot of them get fired if they get injured. If anybody at work finds out that they're linked to the UFW, they get fired. Also, they have excessive amount of injuries because they're handling 1,400-pound cows. And, you know, now, especially with this weather, they fall more often and they get smashed by the cows or get attacked by bulls. There's different issues happening.
What is the union trying to do to address these grievances?
So one of the things that we are trying is we are communicating these issues to the retailers, and that's been the big, you know, a big part of our campaign. We want to let retailers know that, you know, Dairy Gold is not taking responsibility about the working conditions of the workers, and they should be, you know, worried about what's happening or where their milk supply comes from.
What has the response been like so far from both Dairy Gold and the retailers that you've spoken to?
So far, obviously Dairy Gold has not been responsive. We are talking to some retailers now, and you know they are also talking to Dairy Gold. They are proposing solutions to them, maybe some training for the workers. Different ideas are being shared through different retailers and us to put a solution to this issue.
Which retailers have you spoken to?
Costco and also Target. So they've been the ones that have been more they're cooperating the most. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. So earlier this year, there was a labor dispute in Washington that got some media attention. And in that instance, the workers took photos of injured cows that they were working with at the dairies. What is Dairy Gold's record when it comes to animal welfare?
So Dairy Gold claims, you know, that they treat their animals humanely. And so the records that we have, you see, workers are not being trained in how to handle these the cows, even though they probably mark that this cow has an infected udder and then send it to the hospital. But for whatever reason, you know, those cows end back in the milking parlor and continue to be milked even when they're hurt.
Is the union planning any action besides speaking to retailers and reaching out to Dairy Gold?
One of the things that we do is we send out alerts to these retailers. In this case, we've been trying to we visited here and actually in Portland, the headquarters of Fred Meyer's, and we did talk to their public affairs, and you know she listened to the stories of the workers, right? But then we didn't go anywhere after that. We did a couple of leaflets in some of their stores, you know, informing the public of these conditions. But we didn't get a response from a positive response from Fred Meyer's. So now we've been sending, you know, emails to their CEO, Lynn Guss. And then we went to their parent company, Kroger. These companies, you know, claim that they have a high, social responsibility, you know, not just to their employees, but to the entire supply chain of the products that they have in their shelves.
Where can people find you?
Everybody can find us through United Farm Workers, PNW, on Facebook. And on the web, they can find us in ufw.org and then /Dairy Gold.
And Dear Trejo, I want to thank you for your time speaking to us.
Thank you.
That was KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaking with Indira Trejo, Global Impact Coordinator for United Farm Workers.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for his weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. 1 week ago, we witnessed the most corporate money-drenched election in our nation's history. Every election in the future will become the most corporate money-drenched election in our nation's history if we the people don't start paying a lot more attention to the fact that corporations are only allowed to donate money to influence elections, to lobby politicians, and to define the boundaries of reasonable debate on the issues only because corporations have been granted First Amendment free speech rights by the Supreme Court. Money equals speech, screamed the Supreme Court in their 1976 Buckley versus Valeo decision. So you would think that given that our elections are drowning in corporate money, that is making it nearly impossible for the public to figure out what we really think about anything that matters, that concerned citizens would be all over these so-called corporate rights. But you would be wrong. On the day after the election, I listened to hours of news coverage from the corporate and independent media, including the station, and although there was lots of talk about the corporate money that drowned the election, there was hardly a single word about what could actually be done about it. The implication was that nothing could be done about it, that it was pretty much hopeless. That's a very strange point of view, especially when you're hearing it from longtime activists from a whole variety of social movement groups working on GMOs, land use policy, funding for public education, environmental protection, etc. The fact is, it's not true at all that nothing can be done about corporate money and lobbying drowning our political system. It's not true at all. So what's going on here? Could it be that single-issue activists cannot quite get themselves to believe that to win on their individual issues, they're going to have to expand their educating and organizing to include an analysis and strategy to end corporate rights? For example, how could it be that the Yes on 92 GMO labeling campaign did not use any of their hard-earned millions of dollars to reach out to the public and say something like this? Are you sick and tired of Monsanto and other corporations interfering in our right to vote on the labeling of GMO foods by drowning our election in corporate money? Are you sick and tired of Monsanto and other corporations lying to us in their campaign mailers and TV ads? Did you know the only reason Monsanto and other corporations are allowed to participate in our elections at all is that the Supreme Court has granted constitutional rights to corporations? Please join us in working to end corporate constitutional so-called rights so that we the people can take back our elections and have the kind of political discussion that is essential in a democratic society. Let's work together to ensure that Monsanto and other corporations are never again allowed to participate in an election campaign, not their money, not their political voice, not their lies. Because until we get corporations out of our elections, let's face it, it will be nearly impossible to get GMO ingredients out of our foods. This message has not yet been brought to you by the Yes on 92 campaign. I've been waiting for years now to hear this kind of ad from a state ballot initiative campaign. Why is it taking so long? Do these groups really think they can continue to keep up with the ever-increasing spending required to challenge corporate money in elections? We simply can't afford for our citizens' groups to keep waving the white flag of surrender on the issue of corporations. That pathway leads to disaster, so let's not go there. Instead, I urge everyone listening to this commentary to consider having a conversation about this issue the next time you meet up with whatever groups you work with. Tell them that you're ready to start paying a lot more attention to the fact that our elections are in deep trouble and that we can't continue down this path much longer. Tell them that they have to start focusing more attention on corporate so-called rights in how they educate and organize their members. Remind them that the public already thinks it's ridiculous that corporations should have constitutional rights and that this could be a winning strategy in the next round of ballot initiatives. That if we strip corporations of their rights, we can take our elections back and stop having to waste so much time and money. And hey, we'll start winning again too, because let's not forget, the primary opposition to most of our common sense ballot initiatives is corporate. Will you talk about this at your next meeting? And one more thing, is there anyone listening out there who is planning a ballot initiative campaign in the near future? Are you ready to consider my challenge? I would be honored to assist your campaign in developing a new kind of message to voters, one that helps voters understand that this ridiculousness can be ended, that we really can get corporations out of our elections and start having the kind of political debate again that we the people deserve. Can we afford to do anything less? You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the Cable Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcnfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo, followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will see significant snow with as much as 6 inches forecast in the Portland metro area. The high will be 33 with an overnight low of 32. Winds are also expected to blow from the southeast with speeds from 13 to 18 miles per hour, with gusts potentially reaching 25 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1969, reporter Seymour Hersh breaks the story of the My Lai Massacre, in which up to 500 Vietnamese villagers were shot dead by U.S. Army personnel, an incident which occurred in March. In 1991, Indonesian forces opened fire on East Timorese independence protesters, killing 250. The quote of the day is from Dr. Martin Luther King in his 1967 speech, Beyond Vietnam. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
It is 5:26. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
A bumper sticker from around 2008 offered a stinging four-word response to the Bush-Cheney regime's enthusiasm for the cruel sport of waterboarding. Impeach Bush, it urged. Torture Cheney. This comes up again because there's a new push, ironically, coming from the Obama White House, to revive torture as an acceptable practice by the CIA and others for their interrogation of terrorist suspects. The irony is that, on this issue, Obama himself has taken a firm stand. As a U.S. Senator in 2005, he strongly supported a bill by GOP Senator John McCain to prohibit American officials from engaging in cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of detainees, not just on U.S. soil, but anywhere in the world. Then, in 2009, on his second day as president, Obama proudly signed an executive order banning torture. Good. Well done. Solid. But a covey of military and spy agency lawyers are suddenly pushing the administration to embrace a loophole that Bush created after Congress passed the McCain bill. Goaded by his snarling, autocratic vice president, George W. claimed that as commander-in-chief, he could override the torture ban if the cruelty took place in detention camps and other facilities on foreign soil. Even though Obama's 2009 executive order directly refuted the Bush overseas loophole, hawkish forces now want the White House to refute its own refutation, giving torture wiggle room and new life in U.S. foreign policy. Unfortunately, the Obamacans are wobbling. But come on, a ban is a ban, a matter of settled moral principle, a statement to the world of who we Americans are. This is Jim Hightower saying, call the White House comment line to tell Obama to stick to moral principle. Call him at 202-456-1111.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The family of the only person to die of Ebola in the U.S., Thomas Eric Duncan, has reached a settlement with the Dallas hospital where he was treated. While the dollar amount that Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital will pay was not disclosed, some terms were made public. The payout will be divided evenly among Duncan's four children, and the hospital will create a fund in Duncan's name to aid Ebola victims in West Africa. Duncan's family had previously criticized the care Duncan, a Liberian man, received at the hospital. After experiencing symptoms and telling staff he had traveled to the U.S. from Liberia, Duncan was initially sent home by the hospital in what the hospital said was a communication error on their part. In related news, the World Health Organization reports that 200 people have died from Ebola in West Africa since Friday. The virus has killed over 5,100 people, mostly in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In the U.S., the Pentagon has said it is scaling back its deployment of U.S. soldiers in the 25% region to 3,000, and Congress is set up to take President Obama's $6.2 billion emergency aid package to combat Ebola in the region.
The family of Michael Brown, the teenager killed by a policeman in Missouri, has gone to the United Nations to ask for justice for their son's death. A forensic expert hired by the family is testifying today at the grand jury of the officer who shot Brown. The grand jury decision is expected this week or next week, and the family has called on the community to remain nonviolent when the verdict is released. The governor of Missouri has called on the National Guard to be ready to put down any protests that follow the release of the grand jury's verdict. KBOO's Joanna Peterson spoke with Ajama Baraka, who recently wrote an article about police militarization.
When do you think law enforcement began becoming militarized, and what caused it to get to this point?
Well, you know, there's always been a military component to law enforcement in the U.S., but what we find during the modern period, that's, I would say, the modern period being post-World War II, was a push for militarizing police forces in reaction to the social upheavals of the 1960s. In the late 1960s, a series of laws were passed, the Law Enforcement Assistance Act, for example, that facilitated the transfer of arms and trainings from the military directly to the police forces, and allow for local police forces to tap into various federal programs in order to, in essence, expand their stock of armament. This is also the period where you had the development of the SWAT teams, and there's been a dramatic increase in those kinds of paramilitary forces since the late 1960s. So this has been a process that is not new, but has, in recent years, has even more intensified in the post-9/11 period.
Can you tell me a bit about the two semi-recent U.S. bills that aim to halt the militarization of law enforcement?
The latest bill that, and the most important one, was an attempt to reduce, if not eliminate, the ability of the military to transfer stocks of military equipment that was no longer going to be used by the military to law enforcement agencies, but that bill was defeated, and so that process continues. I'm not aware of the second bill that you referred to, but the one that seemed to be the most ominous because of what's happening in the country, and because of the role of some traditional forces that have been opposed to militarization of the police, like the Congressional Black Caucus, you had many members of the Congressional Black Caucus who did not support the bill to halt those military transfers. So that was a very ominous occurrence in the life of this country.
So do you think this bill is leading to real progress, or do you think that white supremacist ideology runs too deep to be resolved by legislation?
Well, I think that there is a social control mechanism being exercised by local police that is increasing as a consequence of the kinds of economic, political, and social crises that we see in the U.S. We know that as a consequence of the current economic crisis, with millions of people thrown into unemployment, with the reduction of expenditures on the local level to address some of the social needs of populations in terms of energy assistance, supporting public education, providing job training, providing extended unemployment benefits, there is a social explosion that is ready to erupt. And it appears that the police forces across the country, in coordination with the federal authorities, have prepared themselves for this explosion. But in the meantime, the element of the society that is still being intensely policed and is at the receiving end of the repressive apparatus on the local level continues to be black and brown people in these various cities. So there's a plan, and the plan is basically to control a restless population and to control segments of the population that are at this point economically redundant.
I've been speaking with Ajumu Baraka, the author of Race and Militarism, From Ferguson to Syria. I'm Joanna Peterson with KBOO News.
Districts. The U.S. Supreme Court today listened to the arguments of black Democrats regarding the use of racial gerrymandering of electoral districts in the state. The Alabama Legislative Black Caucus is complaining that Republicans moved black people into districts that already have black majorities. But questions arose from conservatives on the court who countered that Alabama's lawmakers followed the same guidelines established in the 1990s by the Justice Department. In that era, the districts were set along county and municipal lines, which succeeded in helping black legislators get elected. Now, civil rights advocates are arguing that the Republican-controlled legislatures are going too far by concentrating more black people in districts that already have black majorities. Justice Scalia countered that the caucus is making the same arguments their opponents made some two decades ago. Some of the justices on the court suggested that the case should be sent back to Alabama so judges can take a closer look at some of the districts where more black people were concentrated.
A U.S. official has admitted to the United Nations that the U.S. had, quote, crossed the line in its conduct of the so-called war on terror since the September 11th attacks. The State Department's acting U.S. legal advisor, Mary McLeod, was testifying to the U.N. Committee Against Torture, a 10-person body meeting to review the human rights of countries that signed the Convention Against Torture. The committee criticized the U.S. for its use of secret CIA torture sites and so-called enhanced interrogation techniques during the Bush years and its failure to punish those who were responsible. The U.N. Committee Against Torture also looked into police abuses and other current human rights violations in America. The committee took testimony from human rights activists, a former Guantanamo Bay detainee, and the parents of Michael Brown, the unarmed teen whose killing by police sparked massive protests in Ferguson, Missouri. The U.S. government acknowledged for the first time that the anti-torture treaty applies to all areas controlled by the U.S., including military ships and aircraft. This is a shift from the Bush administration, which claimed that laws against torturing prisoners did not apply to secret CIA prisons overseas. To date, no senior officials have been held responsible for torture and renditions occurring during the Bush administration, and little information has been released to the public.
A Kentucky deputy, who witnesses say jumped onto the roof of a 19-year-old girl's car and opened fire on her, will not be indicted in the girl's death. Samantha Ramsey was killed by Boone County Deputy Tyler Brockman as she left a party in April. Now, a Boone County grand jury has decided not to indict Brockman. In a statement to his supervisors, Brockman said he tried to stop Ramsey from driving away from the party so that he could see if she was intoxicated. Brockman told his boss that Ramsey then took a left turn and ran into him, forcing him up onto the hood of her car. Brockman said Ramsey sped up and the officer shot her four times, killing her. In a statement sent to the Huffington Post, Ramsey's mom, Brandy Stewart, expressed her disappointment in the grand jury's decision. She says that now, 6 months after my daughter was shot to death by Deputy Brockman, the only thing she knows for sure is that he will not answer for his actions. She added that in Boone County, Kentucky, you cannot indict a county deputy for shooting an unarmed 19-year-old four times in front of numerous witnesses.
A lawsuit has been filed against a Pennsylvania state law, which was signed into law last week. The Abolitionist Law Center and the ACLU filed the lawsuit, which contends that the language in the bill is overly broad. The lawsuit says the bill can be used to censor prisoners from speaking out against the system that imprisons them. Mumia Abu-Jamal, a prisoner in Pennsylvania, as well as a journalist, author, and public speaker, is the target of the bill, which was created after he gave the keynote address for Goddard College's graduation. KBOO News correspondent Riley Turner spoke with Brett Grote of the Abolitionist Law Center today to discuss the bill in more detail and the lawsuit filed against it.
Senate Bill 508 is now Pennsylvania Statute 8 under Chapter 18, Title 18 of the Pennsylvania Statute, Section 11.11304, and it provides a cause of action for the victim of a personal injury crime to file a lawsuit in state court when an offender engages in conduct that causes the victim to feel that perpetuates the effect of the crime on the victim. This is, of course, not a self-defining term, so the legislature included a definition of conduct that perpetuates the effect of the crime on the victim, and that definition is conduct that causes a temporary or permanent state of mental anguish. In addition to the victim being allowed to go into court, the district attorney where the conviction was obtained or the state attorney general can go into court and use taxpayer money and resources to try to stifle the free speech rights of people that have been convicted of personal injury crimes. So what this means is that individuals who engage in really any speech or conduct, it doesn't limit it or define it in any way, that an offender or that a victim does not like, that causes them some degree of mental anguish, can be subject to an injunction from a court ordering them to cease that activity.
What is the ultimate goal and motive of the lawsuit filed against the statute, and why do you think there might be grounds for this lawsuit?
The lawsuit is brought on behalf of our clients, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Robert Salim Holbrook, and Carrie Shakabuna Marshall, all imprisoned activists and writers. And Prison Radio, the Human Rights Coalition, and Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And so the lawsuit is intended to protect the speech and associational activities that they engage in routinely day in, day out. And it is seeking to have the law invalidated under the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 7 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, which is the state constitution's free speech, freedom of the press clause. It is arguing that the law is what is known as overbroad. It sweeps too substantial an amount of lawful speech within its reach. It's also void for vagueness under the 14th Amendment. So it's a due process violation if a law is written with language that is so vague that it does not give any guidance to an individual about what conduct is prohibited under the law. And so we are bringing a pre-enforcement challenge, which means we want this law wiped off the books before it's used against our clients or against anybody else on the grounds that it's unconstitutional and it has the effect of chilling the free speech rights of plaintiffs, and it can lead to acts of self-censorship or uncertainty about what type of speech or conduct is permissible under the statutes.
I see. So just finally, is there already a system in place to help prevent re-victimization, or is this even an issue in Pennsylvania or the United States, or is this more of a red herring for, as you're saying, the censorship of prisoner and the limitations of prisoner rights?
Yeah, this is a red herring. I mean, the speech that gave rise to this outcry that led to the passage of the legislation was a commencement address by Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that commencement address to Goddard College, like so much of his other, like all of his other radio commentary or journalism or, you know, public pronouncements or books, does not address his case and does not address the victim in the least bit. And there were no specific examples given in the legislative record of this being a problem. And the one generic example that was given, I mean, no names or anything, was of perpetrators of sexual violence broadcasting the names and addresses of their victims. And this is the type of activity that can be dealt with through existing law. There's laws against harassment, intimidation, threatening the witness, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and other types of tort and criminal remedies for that type of conduct. But this was, a solution in search of a problem. They've wanted to censor Mumia and others who are dissidents and who are trapped within the nation's enormous prison system and prevent them from speaking out, because these are almost always the most incisive and informed critics of that system.
I see. Brett Grody, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you for having me.
This is Riley Turner with KBOO News.
Jillian Pym is one of 137 activists from a group called Food Not Bombs on hunger strike in Fort Lauderdale. The activists are protesting a Fort Lauderdale law that requires people to get a license and provide portable toilets to feed the homeless. So far, 11 Food Not Bombs members have been arrested. Violators face a fine of $500 and up to 60 days in jail. KBOO's Dan Richardson spoke with Jillian today to learn more.
Food Not Bombs is a group that feeds, that shares food with people in protest of war and corporate greed. It's been around for over 30 years. It's an international group. We share food with people that would otherwise be gone to waste. We get donations from farmers markets, from supermarkets, from restaurants, from school cafeterias, and we just go at the end of the night, and it's like the stuff that they would normally throw in the trash, we put in our freezer and then feed it to people.
As far as this new law that's in Fort Lauderdale, what does it do for those who, like members of your group who try to feed the homeless?
It makes it completely impossible for us to comply with any of these ordinances, because we're only in the park for an hour or two, and you can't just hire a porta potty for an hour or two. And it's just...